Right. So, yeah, I'm Hannu Pakkanen, like Sami already introduced me. So basically I'm a laboratory engineer and okay, jack of all trades. I try to be in many places at the same time, sometimes succeeded, not always. But anyway, today I stand here and try to give you some knowledge and background about analytical chemistry. And this is like supporting analysis of biological compounds in natural samples or etc. So all right. So analytical chemistry normally includes separation, identification, and quantitation of matter. And it's mitäs mä
saan tuosta
piiloon vielä. It's good to have professor here beside me. So there can be classical methods, so you know, titration, etc., gravimetric analysis, but here we are focusing on instrumental analysis and give some knowledge and background. It's very difficult to put the limit there that when you have like a, how to say, modern instrumental analysis process, because basically these are like covering. So we have traditional spectroscopic methods, and we are not talking about that they are like modern methods. So UV, this, for example, we don't say that it's modern because it has been used for a long time. But that is normally then combined with HPLC, I mean high pressure liquid chromatographic system, and then it start to be like modern analytical system. So with separation, we want to separate different compounds from our samples. And normally this is happening already in sampling. So basically that can cause separation. So for example, water samples. So you go to lake and you filtrate your sample and for example, then take this precipitate from the filter. So you are that water which is passed through, so you are not interested about that. So that is the like first stage of separation. Then you can go to laboratory and do their different type of separation. So quite often it's meaning that you will have, for example, different type of solvents with different polarities, and you extract certain compounds out of the sample. So this is like a happen. The sample treatment is happening on the field and in the laboratory, and then we have instrument which is separating. I mean chromatographic system, so which is also separating compounds. So this is basically separation process. What is normally happening in chemical analysis? Identification sometimes is it's enough for you to that you know that there are some certain compounds. You are not interested in how much you have it, but you want to look that, okay, do I have that compound in those samples or not? And identification is then it's qualitative analysis. So you get knowledge that what type of compounds you have in the sample. And then there is this quantitative analysis, so you are looking for concentration of those compounds in the sample. So basically all this is like analytical chemistry. Quite often people think about it's only that, okay, you have a label in some certain food stuff or something like that. And then there is said that, okay, you have certain amount. That is like analytical result of how much fat you have in milk, for example. But sometimes it's enough that you identify those compounds. And then, of course, Tuula will talk much more about sampling, but here one idea about that. Okay, what type of samples you have, what you are trying to look for. And this is that way complicated that, okay, you can have homogeneous samples and then heterogeneous. And this is, I think it's a good example, this that you have milk chocolate, so it's homogeneous, and then you have this peanut chocolate, and then you have these peanuts there. And it's certainly very different to analyze those. If you want to see, for example, that what is the fat content in the sample, so you have fat in the milk, this chocolate, but you have also fat in those peanuts. And if you want to have this kind of how to say from the total sample this truthful analytical result, you really have to have quite large sample so that you have how to say the average amount of peanuts in the sample, so it's not small sample, and then you have to somehow like grind it or to homogenize, and then you take some part of that for analysis. So normally you don't take whole this chocolate package to do the analysis, but it's some part of that. And this is very important to understand what type of samples you have. Are they heterogeneous or are they homogeneous? So this is basically the sampling plan that if you go, for example, to the lake, that from what part of the lake you are taking those samples. So it's very important to somehow understand already beforehand that, okay, what you can expect to what type of plankton or fish for these populations you have in different part of lake. So this plan normally it really means that you have to take several samples from each lake and somehow to mark that, okay, here is from the depth, this is from the coastal side. And this is certainly one very important thing because one sample is not representing in nature very well, actually, the average, what we, and normally we want to know some, not to, of course, it's interesting to know that in one point you know that what is the temperature, pH, and then what type of this plankton you may have there. But normally you want to have get the idea of the whole lake, and then you have to have more points to take your samples. So this is very important to understand that much biology there and ecology that you somehow get the idea to have the points which are covering the samples. This is also how to say what is the point of view in your research that normally these fishermen they collect certain fishes. And then scientists came there and want to know the ecology and trophial levels and like that. And they are not, okay, big fishes are part of the research, but fishermen, they are interested about the big fish. So this is somehow about the point of view, how you think about what you are looking for from the lake. And this is like I said already, that you do this separation already normally in the sampling. Not always, but quite often you do it already there. And it's very important to understand that this measurement in the laboratory is not really the how to say, like Sami said, that this analysis is not, cannot be better than the sampling, what you have done. So it's really important to focus to this sampling system. And then we normally have these analytes, what we are looking for there. For example, fatty acids we are going to extract with this organic solvent from the matter. So we have these analytes, but we always have this matrix, and that matrix is also affecting this measurement. It's a background actually there. And in some cases, although we separate with this liquid extraction, these analytes, but there is also may come this matrix to the sample, which we are going to analyze with our equipment. And that is very important to understand, that in some cases, this matrix can cause problems for your analysis. So here you see that, okay, so sampling, sample preservation. So, okay, you are in the lake somewhere, far distance, and you want to know, for example, what, okay, you don't have cooling system there, how you get your sample, which is matching, I mean, to bring it in the laboratory. So the situation with the sample is not anymore like it was at first. So preservation is sometimes needed there. Quite often anyway, this cool chain is there to prevent any, how to say, big changes for the sample. And that is quite often used, but it's depending on what you are looking for from the sample. Then there is this sample preparation in the laboratory, and then here can be different steps in the lab, what you are doing for the sample. And then there is, at the end, there is this analysis with some kind of instrument. All right. So electromagnetic radiation is, I mean, we are using light in quite many measurement system, so to detect compounds in our sample. Of course, there are mass spectrometry, which is also quite a lot of used, but this is, how to say, in if you think about industry, for example, there is not always these mass spectrometers to measure something. They are using quite a lot of these UV-based technology there. And what you have to notice always, I think you are familiar with this, that visible light, where we normally work with UV-vis or fluorescence measurements. So it's really very narrow, very narrow area about all the electromagnetic radiation. And this is, how to say, better here you see that what this electromagnetic radiation is going to cause to molecular stuff. So here, if we think about microwave, for example, so it's giving, okay, you know, microwave you are using every day. So it's making molecules to rotate, and that is causing that they start to heat. So you warm it, like I do normally this cool coffee from the pot. So I use microwave to heat it a little bit. So, and then we have infrared area. So this is causing vibrations. So molecules are giving the or reacting differently depending on the energy of this radiation. And then when we are here in visible and ultraviolet area, so here we see this electronic excitation range. And that's why we are using this UV-Vis for the analysis. And when we go to X-rays, so you know, or okay, if you go X-ray graph from your body, so all the nurses, they go somewhere else when you are in the spot. So that is causing some damage normally to the molecules. And that is, of course, why normally this X-ray is taken really fast, not for a long time. All right. So this electronic excitation, what is causing? So basically, we have in electrons, we have this ground state. And when we have this certain radiation wavelength, which is molecule is reacting with. So it's meaning that then this electron is moving to higher energy level. And this is absorbing then this radiation. And then there is this, there are excited states, and then it might happen that this electron is dropping to lower level, and then it's giving emission, and then we are in fluorescence. So in fluorescence, we have shorter wavelength, excitation wavelength, which is having energy to lift this electron to higher level. And then when it came back, it gives emission. And that is fine in fluorescence measurement. But this absorption here, this is when radiation is disappearing somewhere. So this electron is moving to higher and absorbing this energy and that wavelength. So in basically, if we think about this UV, this measurement, so you can stop me at any point if you have something that I don't understand. This is strange. Ja voitte kysyä myös suomeksi, että ihan älkää pelätkö kysyä. In spectroscopy, this transmittance is what we measure there. So we have this incident light. So this is the light which is coming to from our source. And then we have there this cuvette. Normally it's cuvette where we have something. And then we have this transmitted light which is going through the sample. If nothing is absorbed, so it's meaning that then we have this transmitted light and incident light, they are even. So if you divide that even value, it's giving one. So nothing is absorbed. And then when this transmitted light is decreased, the amount of that, so then it's meaning something is absorbed, and then this transmitted light is under one. And normally this is then given this value as a percentage. So it's meaning that, okay, nothing is absorbed. So 100% transmittance, everything is going through. If 50% is absorbed, so it's meaning that it's 50%, then this transmittance there. Absorbance is quite often used there if you want to. Okay, I use it always, like in infrared spectroscopy also. But it's quite often used when you are going to quantitate this result, because when we go to logarithmic values here, so it's meaning that this absorbance value, so because this is like logarithmic relationship, so absorbance one value one is corresponding to that 10% is transmittance. It's meaning 90% of the light is absorbed. And this is how to say it, very important to recognize that when you are using UVVs, for example, and then you have a cuvette there and you get absorbance value 2. So it's meaning if absorbance with value is 1, 90% of the light is absorbed, only 10% transmitted. If it's 2, we are on logarithmic scale, it's meaning 1% of the light is passing through, 99% of the light is absorbed. And this is then meaning that, okay, it's quite dark there in the detector at that point. And it's very difficult to quantitate if there is no light coming to the detector. So quite often, be aware, if absorbance value with any equipment is going over 1, because then it starts to be very little light which is passing through anymore. So that is, how to say, this kind of thumb rule there, that to get this knowledge from the values. So now I have to be a little bit careful. We anyway, normally we want to be there, south, how to say, there in the linear range in detector response. I think I will try to draw something later about that. So basically here is this, how to say, procedure, and I think here, okay, this is why I put it this same information, but that, this is from Harris quantitative chemical analysis book. Are there some persons from chemistry? Anybody? Nobody from chemistry? Okay. So this is what I have read, and I think mainly these students in chemistry, that Harris book, quantitative chemical analysis, and then they are using P as this mark for the this radiance. Oh, so radiance and irradiance there. So this is how to say that, okay, we are using different type of marking for some for the same information. You can forget it, but all right. So Bell-Lambert law is very, how to say, in the core of analytical chemical analysis when you are using UVVs, and this is giving relationship with absorbance and concentration. So there is this molar absorption coefficient, which is a sample dependent property. So this is very important to you to recognize that molecules, when they are absorbing this radiation, so they are absorbing different wavelengths with different amount. And this is that way tricky that it's really causing this problem that you cannot have knowledge that, for example, you have separated compounds, you get peaks with certain wavelength, for example, 280 nanometers you have used for the measurement, and you have peaks there. But based on the peak size, you cannot know how much stuff you have there. You have to know this molar absorption coefficient of the compound. And that's why you normally have to have standard chemical, which you are using to calibrate the system, because then these responses are different for the different compounds. So, but when you have determined, basically it's meaning calibration with the, so that you know, for example, that it's milligram per liter, so concentration, or if you measure straight, so if you know the molar absorption coefficient, that chemical, that compound, and you have pure compound, so you can then calculate straight this concentration. So here is everything what you need basically then to calculate the concentration of it. Because you measure this absorbance with your equipment, then there is the molar absorption coefficient for the molecule what you are studying, and then there is this wavelength, the length of the cuvette. And if you are using 1 centimeter cuvette, so you can forget the whole cuvette system there. All right, this is something about, I don't know why this slide is here. basically, I talked already something about these classical methods in the start. So, okay. Sorry. But it's okay explaining that there are this kind of, like titration. What you have to then remember that when you are, when we have chromatographic separation, and then we have, for example, mass spectrometer as detector. So if we think about the sample, which is fed into the effluent flow, and it's coming to the detector, it's certainly not 100% of the compounds which are reaching the detector. It's relative amount. But in titration, we have sample in a pot and we are titrating, and we know the total amount of that in what is the amount of those compounds or this sample. So this is very important to understand that it's relative when we are going to make chromatographic separation. In separation, those peaks are spreading. We are integrating the peak in some way. We are losing something in the base line. We cannot have everything there. And then, very important thing to understand about mass spectrometer is this, that when molecule is coming to the mass spectrometer, and how it can go through the filter system there in mass spectrometer is meaning that molecule must ionize. And it's not happening 100% certainly. It's, in some cases, it's only few percent of the molecule which is going to the detector. And this is very important to understand. Because mass spectrometer, when only a small amount of sample is coming there, so what's the condition? What is it we have used for 1 year, haven't cleaned at all, and then we are going to clean that ion source area, and we have clean surfaces, And suddenly we see, okay, now we have good peaks from the samples. Earlier we have had some, okay, but we manage with that. And that is important then, that we quite often, we have to have internal standard there, which is used in the calculation. And we, at the end of this lecture, we are going to the internal standard system. All right. This is something, okay, I think briefly I said it already. So chromatographic separation, you know chromatography? Who don't know? Everybody knows. All right. So basically we have there stationary phase and moving phase. And we want to separate compounds, and typically we said that it's a column where we are having the separation of those compounds. And then we have this some kind of detector, which is giving us a graph about the peaks of those compounds. And here, for example, you see that the separation has happened, and we have two different type of peaks, one narrow and one which is a little bit spread. And that is rather typical in chromatographic system, that first of all, you try to separate all those compounds so that they are like individual peaks. Because if they overlap, then you have a little bit problems there. And this is also very often happening, that if you are using isographic elution, for example, in LC. So the first peaks, because they are shorter time in column, so it's sharper peak. But the longer it will stay there, and you have same this elution strength when you are not changing the composition of the solvents. If you are some same pure solvent all the time, it will always happen so that the first peaks are sharp, and then the later coming peaks, they are spreading. And Elina will talk more about that, how you tune and affect these chromatograms. And this is meaning that okay, you want to have stronger elution force in those compounds, so that which are more stuck to the column, so you can push them out fast. And then it's meaning that you change the concentration of, for example, in LC, you change the concentration of those solvents. And okay, we give something to Elena so that I don't explain more, because it's okay, it's better to do that. In gas chromatograph, I think there should be figure here. So these cones, they are very different type. In gas chromatograph, it's normally a very narrow tube. So column is looking like a, what is this? Capillary is around a rack, and can be like 30 meters, 60 meters long, in some cases even 100 meters long. Very narrow, inner diameter of the hole which is going through the column is 0.25 millimeter to 0.5, depending on the application. And then we have a sample injection. Your sample can be like dissolved in a solvent. You inject small amount of that solvent, and then there is the liner here, which is heated, and then this your solvent and your compounds, they will evaporate immediately. And then we have the here this gas flow, which is pushing the sample to the column. And normally you don't use isothermic program in GC analysis because, okay, if you have one compound there, or you synthesize and you have like two or three, because something is always like a waste there. So then you can have this kind of isothermal program. But if we go to nature, we want to separate different compounds. Well, so we go to lipids, fatty acids, and then there are very different type of boiling points for those fatty acids. So okay, I know that there are groups which are using 2 hour programs to measure fatty acids because they are using, it can be a column problem or decision, but it's meaning that it's taking a long time. But how to make this happen faster is that we make a temperature program there. And then we have this oven where the column is at the lower temperature. This is injection. This is always higher temperature here than in this column. So everything is evaporated. It's going to the column. It's cooler than injector. So then it will stuck to the film, which is covering the inside of this column. And we have different type of films there for the separation. And then those compounds which are very volatile, so they can go quite fast through the column, but those which have higher boiling point, they will stuck there for, and they won't come out. It's really not, how to say, it's you, because there's this carrier flow, which is normally, it can be quite often helium, but it can be nitrogen and sometimes argon. If you increase the flow rate there, it's not helping you to get these compounds out from the film. It's a little bit that they are really stuck there, and it doesn't matter, although this wind is moving the one corner of the molecule. It's there. And then if you start to heat it, this column, so how to say, it's like fire in the ass. So it's pumping you out there at some point. So this is an energy system. So you heat the molecule, it's going to this volatilization level, and then it's free in the inner diameter, and this gas flow is pushing it through the column to the detector. And here, then it's solvent, what you are in liquid chromatographic system. So it's a solvent which you are pumping through the column. And normally those are looking like tubes, which are filled with some certain standard phase for the separation. And then the detector here, it's like here, for example, this is UVs, because here we see that different colors, it's spreading then to detector. This here we have source and here we have detector. And sample is passing through the cuvette, absorbing at some certain wavelength and giving you the chromatogram. This is now explanation of how to say example that how this molar absorption coefficient, which these compounds have, how it's affecting to the absorption and what we see in the chromatogram. So this is diode array detector, and we have here three different compounds, very similar type, aromatic compounds, alcohol, aldehyde, and acid, which were separated I will say anyway that C18 column, so this kind of reverse phase system, and then Elina explain you that what is that. Here you see retention time. So we have time around 10 minutes here. This benzyl alcohol is coming first. Then we have vanillin at 11 almost, and benzoic acid late, the last here. And here at U-axis, you see the absorbance. And then here we see to Z dimension here, this wavelength of the detector. And with this diodary detector, it's possible to have this three-dimensional information of the separation of those. And we see the spectra. So basically, if you think about that, you put pure vanillin in cuvette and you measure with UV vis so that you scan the spectra of that. So you would see then these. So here we see, you see that 220 nanometers to 300. So you would see this type of spectra from this vanilla. Then you measure straight there. But here we have separated and we have like a chromatogram type. So this is like a hills which were separated. And then it's next thing is that, okay, where from which point we are looking for it? Is it here from the retention time? So we will see the spectra of that compound. Or if we look for the wavelength direction, we will see the chromatogram with that certain wavelength. And that is should be then in the next slide. So here, two different wavelengths, not much difference in the wavelength itself, because 245, 280 nanometers. And then there is quite equal amount, equal concentration of all these compounds. And you see that peak sizes differ a lot. So this vanillin, if we go back here, so we go to 280. So you see here that, okay, this benzyl alcohol peak couldn't be very, very big because spectra of in this point is quite low. And then we have vanillin, we have quite high absorption there. And then also benzoic acid, not much. And it's actually here what we see in the chromatogram at 280 nanometers. So this is very informative system because it's three-dimensional data there, what we can look from different corners. Did you get it? This is telling us, okay, it's you need to know what it's trying to tell us. Because if we go back there, so you recognize this, that, okay, concentration similar for all these compounds, approximately, I have waited. So it can be a small difference. But same concentration, and then when we go to, we have separated, so we see that different size of peaks, and then you go to Lambert-Bayer law, and you think about what it's telling. You measure absorbance, and then there is the smaller coefficient value. And that's the where it's connected. That is connecting, I mean, this chromatogram and this earlier three-dimensional image here. So this is in relation with Lambert-Bayer law. And always this molar extinction coefficient is depending on the wavelength, what is used for the radiation. So you see that it's the spectra here. So there are hills and valleys, and it's not even. Otherwise, Bjelland's law, you don't need it. But because spectra is not even, but there are different hills and valleys, so it's meaning that you have to know what wavelength you are using for your measurement. And it's varying a lot. If you think about more this, I would say this is 254. Okay, maybe we see a little bit here. Here you see that vanillin, it's approximately 500 observance units. This is a, what is this? It's marked like milli observance units. And if it's like milli, that could be like 0.5 if it's UV this, but in LC system, it's a little bit different symbol. You can forget. But anyway, here you see that it's 60 or something. So, okay, there is a 10 times difference. And this wavelength is changing only from 254 to 280. So absorbance at 280 for vanillin is 10, almost 10 times more than at 254. So this, what you have try to put in your mind is that this molar coefficient is, absorption coefficient is depending on the wavelength. And then the molecule itself. They have different spectras, different absorptions. So,
lähdet laskemaan konsentraatiota, niin kannattaa niin kuin katsoa se, mistä tulee korkein.
Yeah, well, this is a very good question. This that what wavelength you are using to quantitate your sound. And quite often it's really that, like you said, that okay, the highest point. But in some cases it's better that okay, you have two peaks which are quite close to each other. Separation hasn't succeeded very well. But if we could use this, for example, that you have this benzoic acid and vanillin, and you have that way that, so if you think about this 240, for example, and if here we succeeded very, very well in separation, but if we don't succeed, that these peaks are coming close to each other, so then you have always problems with this benzoic acid. But this vanillin, you can filter, you don't use this 240 because this is absorbing at the same, similar way there, but then you can use here this higher absorption. I mean, here you see that this is dropping to baseline. So you go to 300, for example. And then you use that for the vanillin. But where to measure this benzoic acid? That's difficult if they are overlapping with vanillin. But this is an example here based on what we have in hands at the moment. But quite often you look for the maximum point, and then don't use, if there is a very in spectra, so here is it going backwards? It shouldn't. Sorry, I'm a little bit more forward. So it's meaning that here you see that it's high point, but then this is a little bit tricky because we have very fast decrease in the response here at close to this. I would then target that over here. It's because changes in the spectra are not so fast, and that can be in sometimes in different solvents. They are making this kind of movements in the spectra, and that is then tricky if there is a point where it's changing really fast. This absorbs in the spectra, but that is case by case, molecule by molecule, that how you choose it. But it, like a thumb rule, look first for the maximum absorption point for quantities. All right. Is this to quarter to 12? Okay, half one. All right, sure. Then we have chromatograms, and then we have to somehow process those. I think I will explain a little bit. You can read from here, but then later when we are talking about there. But we are looking for peak areas. In some cases, have you used peak height to quantities? Has somebody used peak heights for quantities? What about area? Yeah. In some cases, peak heights are used, but the peak areas is more common. It's but then we are coming to that problem that if we don't have good separation, that there is some peak coming, like over. So if integration is not easy there, so then height is easier to work with. So there are what we reports we want to. Of course, we have to know what analyte we are analyzing there, and how we can separate it there in the chromatogram. And I said that way that if you have complex, I think there was a little bit. For example, here you start to have a lot of peaks in your chromatogram, and if you start from zero and you go to the whole chromatogram through, and you have in report the peak areas of all those, I would say shit, which is coming there at the end of like cleaning stage. I don't want to that in the report list. And here, for example, they have done so that I don't. Do you see? I don't see. Although so minimum area is in the start. It's given some value, so you see that there are some minor peaks here. You are not interested in. You give area limit for the peaks, so you can choose that. Okay, I'm not interested about those minor peaks. And then there is some who is always interested about the minor peaks. So then he is in the creating whole stuff there. But this is helping you to report and read then your reports and collect the data. So quite often there is this kind of area limitation. And here you see also that integration is starting at 0.5. So this like initial, how to say, it's like injection peaks, which are quite often coming there, can't be based on pressure even there. So this is something we want to get rid of. And then it's ending here at 6.5 minutes. So over here. So we are not interested about this stuff, which is here, which is something we only that we clean the column here at the end of the run. And then we have in report, we have those peaks which are marked and integrated. And this is normally the target that you focus to those compounds. you really want to
analyze there. Yeah. Here it's something about this integration. I start to talk a little bit of the height and area too early, maybe. But now you get the idea that when we have this peak, here is marked with color. So this is really nice separation here. All the peaks are separated quite nicely, ion chromatographic system. So anion chromatographic separation. But you see also that very likely this is isocratic run because the peaks are spreading at the end. And that's what we normally that in it's okay, it's depending. At the university, we quite often we want to go to gradient program in all the analytical steps, but it's sometimes it's wise to do this kind of isocratic. Here you see that okay, there is a peak. So this is the highest point of peak, so called apex. This is then height of the peak at that point. But we have this start for the peak, end of the peak, and then when we draw this integration line there, so then it's calculating area for the peak. And I recommend that please use this area for quantitation. But of course, it's not forbidden to use this to calculate based on the height. But this is sometimes it's. I would say that chromatographic system changes if there happens something in the separation during a long run. You see a little bit more difference in height than in air. So it's a little bit more robust. But of course, if separation of the peaks is not working well, so then you can use this height. And then this is that when we are like marking this or making this integration. So here you see three different integration, same chromatogram, but integrated different. And this is a little bit, how say, this is like a fly ship to some person's idea. Please don't talk about that, but it's important to understand this, that how this integration is affecting in your peaks. Does it matter or not? This kind of small peak has separated. So we have algorithm which can like follow this integration of the peak first peak. And algorithm can follow it so that it's like following the tail of the big peak, and then we have this small peak over this big peak. Or classical, so that baseline integration and then valley to valley. So we divide. Or then we are using threshold. So this is like how fast this integration value, response value is changing there. And when it's like going smaller, so threshold is like a cutting integration at that point. And this is normally causing this, that it's not going according to baseline, but it's lifting so that something from the tail is not integrated. And sometimes it's causing problems. If you have to quantitate these two compounds, which integration style you would choose? Who will use these base-to-base integration. Nobody? Who will choose this baseline? This is like vertical division. So baseline integration with valley in valley to valley integration. Okay, quite many. And who will choose then this not configured? So this is based on some algorithm here that how it's following this big peak. Who will choose this? All right, one at least. Yeah. I would choose this first option here, but you are not wrong with the second option, because this is how it's quite often done, almost always. But in some cases, relatively, if you think about this error, what is coming there. So we have the okay, that was really large. And so if you integrate it here, then you think about that you lose that much area in this big peak. It doesn't matter. But what you get extra here, because this is like a tail from the big peak, so that is passed to the area of this smaller peak, that tail. So relative error is can be quite big, very fast. So, but this is, are we interested about that peak there? If we are looking for only the it's not straight. I'm a little bit forward. Yeah. But anyway, you get the idea that relatively that can cause quite a lot of the error to the result amount of that smaller concentration peak. All right. Then something about the units. So this is in physics, they are always using this 10 over something and like that. But it's, I mean, in like daily life, if you think about centimeters, millimeters, you don't explain to your colleagues, for example, that, okay, I measure very strictly that, and it was that the five multiplied 10 over minus 3 meters, that difference. You said that it's five, that was 5 millimeters. So this is also that we quite often use these prefixes there in units. And then this is at some point when you are calculating results, then you have to go to the values. And this is something which is, the more you calculate, the more experience you have, and the units start to match there. But in some cases, it's in the start can be very, very, how to say, tricky to find that you don't recognize that, for example, that you have this error in like micro to nano, although it's then over 3. So 1,000 difference there. If you think about 1 millimeter and 10 meters, you recognize it easily. But if you calculate those micro and nano, it's the difference is same, but it's not easy to recognize. Then you get familiar, you calculate more. There are that kind of units also, like these parts per million and parts per billion, Are you familiar with those? Is there somebody who has never heard? Everybody knows. Okay. So parts per million, parts per billion. And this is quite often then that in if we think about this weight-based system, so in minerals, that's then it's meaning that it's milligram per liter. So parts per million. So, and you also, this is helping you to understand that when you scale, for example, that you go to pipette in the laboratory and you take 1 milliliter or 10 microliters, then it's helping you to use these units that it's same concentration. So milligram per liter, ppm, is like nanogram per microliter. So this is like helping you to, you know what's the concentration. So you have prepared, for example, so that is milligram per liter, some standard there. And then you take then microliters of that. It's helping you that you know 10 nanograms per microliter. You can say then in nanograms, how much standard you put in your sample. So this is like you scale, it's same amount, but you scale there in different units. And then if you analyze gas samples, so this is then volume-based, this ppm in gases. And this is, I'm not sure, what is the average CO2 at the moment? This is from, it's not fresh value, but I think it's anyway somewhat higher at the today. So this is history, what you see here, this 407 ppm. Okay, calibration, like I said earlier, that is important. There are not really universal detectors which are giving same response to, I mean that you have two different compounds and then you separate those and you have chromatogram. Flame ionization detector is closest to the universal detector because every carbon is then giving you quite similar response. But there are metrics somewhere, sometimes, but it's closest to universe. And then if you want to quantitate, it's meaning that you have to have these standards, standard samples, and then you determine with your equipment. So you separate, you have in chromatogram peaks, and then normally, let's see. Calibration, how many points you have to take? Is two enough? Or is one enough? This is, it can be. But if you think about this in biology, you go to and if it's like environmental samples, so there's quite a lot of variation in the concentrations. So you quite often you want to have a little bit broader calibration because it's really important that when you do this calibration, so you have here this, for example, this milligram per liter concentration. This is seeming that it's quite linear. Then you have a sample which response is something. I mean, here we have the response from the detector.
And it shows that it's over here, quite high. I mean, higher than where this your calibration is going. And now, if we go back to think about this, that what's the observance is meaning? I pulled a little bit already. So we have observance and we have value 1 over here. And then, do you remember that when we have observance 1, how much light is passing through the cube? Yeah, and that might happen then that if you continue this calibration, you have linear range, and then you have dynamic. Response is increasing, but not linear anymore. And this is that way very dangerous, that if you think about this is going over your calibration range, these were like we didn't measure. This is something that what it would be that it would if we had standards with higher constants. So basically, we give result. Okay, if we continue this over here, so it's over here this concentration, but didn't reach it that with those standards. At some point it will be, but anyway, that you see that what it can cause a lot of error to the real result. So this is something that you, if it's going over with the compared to your calibration, what options you have there. I mean, this is your sample. It's giving quite high value. Would you report it straight based on this calibration curve? Or what you would do? One easy system is that you dilute your sample. And then you see that, okay, what it's giving. If it's coming back there to, I mean, half the response, it's meaning that your system is basically linear here. But because you don't know, if you don't have these standards analyzed here. So dilution, you diluted your sample to the calibration range. And this is a little bit problematic that if you start to measure, you read some foreign article and it's okay, we are now in Finland. And then we think about, okay, some compounds, we should have that also similar way in those butterflies, for example. And you expect that you find that much in your samples. And then nature is complex. It has surprised me. It's always the problem is here at the biology side. I mean, my career was with process liquors and pulp production like that. And always there is this knowledge that, okay, we are on this level with the samples or concentrations.
And then when we start to look for some unidentified compounds in, for example, butterfly neck droplets or something like that, we didn't have any idea that what to expect to happen. And then, because there is a lot of variation, so first five samples, there's nothing. Our system is not working. So a terrible system, how to improve it. And then when we have suddenly some other samples, it's working fine. So this is, it's that way, how to say, problematic, interesting, but problematic that you don't know always that where your sample concentrations are if you start to develop a new method. So if you start a new, you want to have, for example, in your master thesis or PhD, a lot of analysis, and I want to develop this kind of analysis of those molecules, take time to learn. It's normally not as straightforward as you expect. So this is that kind of hint for you. But it's, of course, don't afraid to go further. All right. So here, this I want to show for you. Okay, it's done on the chemistry side, but this is student work. Earlier there was, pass it over this calibration, that normally could, you can use this calibration, linear calibration, basically so that if the correlation value is over 997, and here you see that this is much higher. And this is really students have diluted the samples. We have analyzed with the HPLC, traditional, not modern equipment at all. And you see that here these correlation. This is really linear and well done calibration. So this is how to say, I want to say that you students, you can do things and very well, because this is student work. All right. Internal standard. That much I have to say. I'm all the minutes, but some took my time. So, so internal standard is okay. If you think about this kind of calibration, external calibration, it means we have fewer standards. Sometimes we put some matrix solution there that we have same matrix, quite similar matrix than with our sample. But anyway, it's external. And in some cases, this background of the sample is causing matrix effect, which is decreasing, very seldom increasing. Decreasing response of the detector. And internal standard idea is there that you add a compound which you don't have in your sample, but it is chemically very similar compared to your analyze. You put certain amount of that, and beforehand you have with standards, you have determined with pure standards, so you have run internal standard chemical, and then this your analyte standard. You have known amount in your standard sample. And then you see that what's the response of either standard and that standard analyte, and you can calculate the relation of the responses. What is the relation of inter standard to this external standard? This is your analyzed compound. And what is good there with inter standard is that
it's in the same matrix with your sample. So it's correcting the in GC, sometimes not if Zurich is okay, but there is really small amount, volume of that injection. So it's correcting also the injection volume. So because if injection is smaller, so also the peak of the interval standard is smaller. So it's correcting these errors in sample treatment. And also when you put in your sample treatment in the start, if you have problems in the sample treatment process, you will see that interval standard amount is dropping if you compare to pure interval standard and then treated interval standard. So, all right. I'm not faster this year compared to last year. I'm at the same point. Sorry. We see there later. All right. Questions? All right. Thank you.